Dr. Leary, you began research with LSD and other hallucinogenic drugs in the summer of 1960. How did you come to be interested in it to begin with?
Well, I wasn't interested. As a matter of fact, I've always been very prejudiced against drugs because I've objected to psychologists or other professionals using methods of probing other people's minds. It was rather accidental. I had rented a house in Cuernavaca, which, as many of your listeners may know, is one of the most beautiful spots in the North American continent. And we had a swimming pool and beautiful weather in the summer. And a friend from the University of Mexico, an anthropologist, came over one weekend with a bag full of mushrooms. I had heard very little about the visionary experience up until that time, and completely unprepared, except surrounded by a panoramic situation, and feeling secure and trust in my friend, because he's a competent, responsible person, I ate 9 of these mushrooms, and for the next 5 hours, I had an experience which taught me that there's a tremendous amount more within the range of human awareness than I had ever had any notion of.
When you say that you had always objected to the use of drugs in psychology, do you mean drugs like sodium pentothal and things of this sort, kind of truth serum?
Yes, I had objected in principle to giving drugs to a subject unless he knows exactly what's happening, unless he's prepared, unless he's a collaborator in the experience. And, of course, this is not considered the standard controlled way of running a drug study.
As a clinical psychologist, what was your experience before this time? I mean, what kind of research did you do?
I had worked for about 12 years as a psychotherapist in the Kaiser Clinic in Oakland, and was research director of the Kaiser Clinic, studying the process and outcome of psychotherapy. So I knew a great deal about how much psychotherapy did and did not do, which has been very useful in measuring the effects of these drugs upon subsequent behavior change.
Then how did you come to be associated with Harvard University, and how did you come to begin some kind of organized research there?
Well, I was teaching at Harvard. I was had a great deal to do with the clinical and psychotherapy training program at Harvard. After my own experience in Mexico, I felt that this was had opened up possibilities for self-understanding and for behavior change, which has dwarfed the techniques of talking, which frankly aren't very effective according to any measured criterion. So I went back to Harvard that fall, and I looked around for some way to make available to other people for therapeutic and life-changing purposes, these experiences. Now, very fortuitously, that fall, Aldous Huxley was in residence at MIT in Cambridge. It was during the MIT centennial. I phoned Mr. Huxley, and he came over to Harvard and was in on the original planning of our research project there. We learned from Aldous Huxley to build into our project values which I say would be humanistic, as opposed to doctor-patient or psychopathological or neurosis and sickness models of human nature.
Well, what were some of these research programs, and how were they humanistic rather than psychopathological, say?
Well, the point number one, how are they humanistic? We recognized that this was an entirely new area, and that we knew little more about it than the subject. So our contract with the subject was collaborative. When you're studying behavior, you can observe from the outside what the person is doing. When you're studying consciousness, no one from the outside can tell what's going on, so you have to change your strategy. You have to make a partner of the other person and say, we'll provide the drug, and we'll provide you with all the information we have about it, and we'll provide a setting which will be as comfortable and aesthetic as possible. But then it's up to you to tell us what you experience and how you think we can use this drug for your own benefit and for the benefit of mankind.
And also now, does this imply a focusing on the mental aspects of the drug rather than the physical?
Oh, yes. our work has been entirely on the experiential aspects. That is, we've worked only with human beings, and we have not done physiological study.
You haven't done anything like taking blood pressure and or
any No, for two reasons. One, we're not physiologists, and secondly, that the studies of the physiological reactions to these drugs are pretty negative. That is, the conclusions are that they don't affect the body very much. They're pretty specifically connected with nerve or synaptic action.
We keep saying these drugs. What are some of the drugs, and what is the difference between them?
Well, first of all, I think I should point out that these substances occur naturally. These substances are very closely related to serotonin, which our neurophysiologists tell us is a very important agent in allowing us to communicate or to experience or to perceive the world around us. So we all carry around something like LSD, and if we didn't, I wouldn't be here talking to you, and our listeners wouldn't be sensing and perceiving what I'm saying. Then these substances occur in nature in innumerable forms. Every month these days, a botanist is coming up with a new plant, a new root, a new vine, a peyote, mushrooms, vines, and so forth.
I understand that Jimson weed, which grows commonly all over backyards all over the Middle West, has some such substance in it.
Well, I hadn't heard that one, but I'm not surprised. Alan Watts was telling me the other day about a seaweed. It seems that as fast as we pass a law to keep consciousness contracted, nature pops up another key to help open things up again. Well, in addition to these natural vegetable compounds, in the last 15 years there's been an extraordinary breakthrough on the chemical side. An amazing chemist named Dr. Albert Hofmann of Sandus Laboratories in Switzerland accidentally discovered LSD in one of the most dramatic pages in human history to us, and since then has gone on to synthesize psilocybin, which is the active ingredient of the sacred mushroom of Mexico. He's also synthesized the active consciousness-expanding substance in Olaluque, which is a sunflower or morning glory seed. So there's a whole family of drugs, so that you can't talk about LSD alone. LSD is simply the most famous or infamous of an ever-growing number of...
It's also the most powerful, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
How much more powerful is it, say, than marijuana or hashish?
Oh, well, you're into something entirely different there. When you're working with LSD, you're working in millionths of a gram, and that's what makes it perhaps so spooky, that such a tiny amount of substance can transform a person's life for 6 hours and perhaps for many years thereafter.
What would be the effect, say, of an overdose? If you're talking in terms of a millionth of a gram, what if you got 20 millionths of a gram, or say as much as half a gram?
Yeah. Well, in order to overdose someone physically, that is, to make them physically sick or perhaps poison them, you'd have to use more LSD than perhaps has been used in most of the research studies. You'd have to multiply the dosage 100 times. Of course, when we get into this topic, a table salt is lethal. If you take, we know the babies die in the hospital if they get 2 or 3 spoons of ordinary salt, so that LSD... is not physically dangerous. There was an editorial in the authoritative Medical Tribune, March 18th, in which it was clearly stated that these drugs are not a physical problem.
I think one of the interesting things that so few people realize is that aspirin is not only potentially lethal, that it actually is, and that very, very many children die each year as a result of taking an overdose of aspirin.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't advise leaving LSD pills around for children or for anyone else who might take them accidentally. Not necessarily because of the physical danger, but because that such a dramatic transformation of your consciousness, unless you know what's going to happen, is a very frightening experience.
Well, you've been undergoing some difficulties recently. Your research program at Harvard, which we should probably talk more about, but first let's... notice that it was discontinued by the university, isn't that correct?
Yes, we have had a very uneasy relationship with Harvard since we started this research. At one point, about a year and a half ago, a committee was set up with a university physician and several prominent professors who, in a sense, were going to protect us against rumors. But even when they had control of the drugs, rumors are still popping up. And one dose of black market LSD in a city starts, you know, 1,000 or 3,000 rumors. So at this point, we all felt that this research was too controversial and that the effect of these drugs was too dramatic to be conducted in a university setting. So last fall, we organized an independent research organization called IFIF, International Federation for Internal Freedom. On the board of directors are 8 very prominent scientists, philosophers, and religious leaders from the Boston area, mainly from MIT, Harvard, and divinity schools in the Boston area.
And where are you located?
Well, we have a suite in Boston's newest medical building, but we're being thrown out of there, as a matter of fact, because some of the doctors felt that we weren't practicing medicine. And, of course, all along, we've been very eager to have doctors come in with us. We've wanted to locate our work in the hospital at Harvard, but people are so afraid of these experiences that we weren't able to do that.
Well, almost all the criticism that I've heard of the use of such drugs claims that they are unreliable and that if administered to the wrong person, that very dangerous results can ensue psychologically. What is the basis for this kind of criticism?
Well, there's no factual basis. All of the statistical studies which have been published in the psychiatric literature indicate that these drugs have insignificant psychological or emotional damage, this last thing. But let's not kid ourselves about this. They can scare you. They can frighten you. Unless you know what's going to happen, you can go through 6 hours of the most severe panic that you can imagine. The reason for this is that much of the psychiatric research has not prepared the subject for what's happening. We always have to use metaphors, and I hope you'll excuse me if I rely upon a very familiar metaphor. We say the cortex, the human brain, is like a huge jet airplane. Most of us, even the most enlightened of us, spend most of our time pushing this airplane around the ground clumsily and feebly because we don't have the key to the motors and we don't know how to operate the plane. Now, what LSD does, it turns on the motor. There's a tremendous power in the unleashed nervous system, which can just shake you and scare you when you sense it. So that in order to use this fantastic machinery, which we carry around in our skulls, we're going to have to train people to operate. And that's the function. It's a main function of our research group right now.
Well, Time magazine cited one case of a psychologist who administered a dosage of one of these drugs to himself, and they claim that he is still seriously ill. Do you know what they're referring to there?
Yes. Matter of fact, I know the psychologist that this happened to. This fellow is a very brilliant but somewhat eccentric person who was always had intermittent episodes of extraordinary lucidity and creativity followed by depressions. This fellow took LSD by himself and didn't have anyone to talk to. Rule number one is don't ever take LSD unless you have someone around that knows how to help you pilot the ship. Rule number two is have someone around who can understand what you're talking about. You see, there's a great social problem caused here. Anytime anyone takes LSD and goes back home and tells their wife about it, you know, or tells your family about it, they're going to think you're nuts because they don't know what you've experienced. So this fellow was in a period, he's always a pretty isolated fellow, and after he had the experience, he went into a depression which lasted about 6 months. He's now back on his feet and is writing very creative articles. And it was not the LSD that did it. He was this way before. And for that matter, we feel that losing your mind, if you do it under the right circumstances where you're protected, is one of the greatest things that can happen to a person because, you know, your mind keeps you from learning. We pay a heavy penalty for having these intellectual minds that we carry around with us, because everything, every concept you learn, in a sense, stands in your way of experiencing a lot of other concepts.
Well, apparently you're reaching far beyond the just the kind of the immediate impact of the drug and transforming consciousness into something else. But first I'd like to talk about the immediate impact of the drug. Say, could you describe the sort of experience that one would be likely to have under an ordinary dosage of LSD, say?
Well, I think rather than try to describe it in my lame poetry, I would recommend your listeners to the books by Aldous Huxley, Doors to Perception, Heaven and Hell, and more recently his utopian novel Island. Alan Watts has written a very sensitive description of a series of his LSD experiences in a book called The Joyous Cosmology, which Dr. Alpert and I wrote the foreword to. Then there are several other books, Myself and I, and Exploring Inner Space, written by Los Angeles residents, which, again, give the subjective picture. One thing I want to leave in the minds of your listeners is that the drug has no single effect except to expand your consciousness. What you experience is entirely a function of your set, that is, your preparation, what you're looking for, what you know about it when you go into it, and the setting, that is, the environment in which you take it. Now, we've done studies conclusively demonstrating this. Last Good Friday, we turned on, in a double-blind study, 15 divinity students in a Boston church, and 15 other students took a placebo, that is, they took a sugar pill. We wanted to see what effect the drug would have. Now, these youngsters wanted to have a religious experience, and the environment, the setting, was very spiritual, hymns, candles, and so forth. And 9 out of the 10 reported the deepest experience, religious experience of their life. If your preparation and your aim is to have an intellectual experience, and you surround yourself with stimuli, books, turn on a tape recorder with the works of Plato and so forth, you'll have an intellectual experience. If your set and intention is to have kicks, to have fun, well, you'll certainly do it, because there's no question that these drugs will dramatically intensify any experience that you have.
When you say 9 out of 10 had religious experiences, do you mean 9 out of 10 of those who took the drug, or 9
That's
out
right.
of 10 of the total group?
No, 90%, yeah, of the people who took the drug had a deep religious experience.
And how about the other 10%?
Well, they... this is a PhD thesis at the Harvard Divinity School, which is just being completed now, and the fellow who's writing the thesis has an index of the mystic experience which runs up to 400. The average of the drug takers was 300 and something, the average on this index. The average of the non-drug takers was around 15 or 20, so it's a tremendous difference.
But some of those who took the placebos felt they had a mystical experience?
No, they had... They had moving experience. They had a very devout experience. But on the on this checklist of what is a mystic experience, they didn't come close to it.
What about the circumstance where somebody is already suffering from some kind of psychopathological condition, which may be fairly severe? Do these drugs in any way aggravate any of these conditions?
Again, it depends on the set and the setting. the problem is that most psychiatric treatment patients are treated like second-class citizens. They often aren't told what treatment they're being given or why they're being given this treatment. And if LSD is given to a psychotic in a hospital, he's going to consider it one of a series of hellish experiences he's had perhaps that month or in the last year. We have found that... mental stability or predisposition to neurosis is not a factor at all. It's the intentions and the circumstances. Now, let me give you an example. 2 years ago, we started giving these drugs in a state prison, a maximum security prison in Massachusetts. We were working with the most dangerous criminals in Massachusetts, men who by definition were impulsive, had no self-control, were likely to hit you if they didn't like the way you looked. We run over 100 ingestions with these men, and we've never had a moment of friction or violence. Why? Because we spent many, many, many hours with them ahead of time explaining to them what was going to happen. We had members of our staff take the drug with them. The first person ever to take drugs in Concord State Prison was myself, and the reason I did that was to show them that we weren't doing anything to them. This was an experience that we believed in, and we'd share it with them. We did everything possible to make the experience pleasant. The last time we ran a session there, we had graduate students from Harvard bringing oriental rugs into a state prison. The guards thought we were nuts. We were bringing in candles and tape recordings with the music they asked for. This was to set up a pleasant, supportive environment for them to lose their minds. And they proceeded to lose their minds in an ecstatic and a deeply religious type of experience.
Did you notice any other effects of this research? I presume that it was aimed at reforming the conduct of these people in some way or other.
Right. Yeah. The reason that we picked out the prison was because the prison gives you a good baseline. You can count the bodies a year after and find out whether they're in or out of prison. You can keep score. One of the problems in psychotherapy and all psychiatric work is you never know when you scored a hit or a home run because there's no way of measuring adjustment. But you can measure whether a prisoner has stopped getting caught for crimes. Now, the prison which we were working, Concord State Prison, was the one studied by the Glucks in their classic experiment, statistical investigation of recidivism or the return rate. The return rate at this prison is around 70%. After a year and a half now, 22% of our prisoners are back, so that we've more than cut the crime rate in half in this pilot study.
Could this be due to any other factors? Could it be due to the particular group chosen? How many prisoners were used? 15?
In this study, there were 35 prisoners.
And did you try to get prisoners that represented all different kinds of crimes and different kinds of psychological...
Yeah, if anything, the sample was loaded for the toughest prisoners. But the selection was made by parole officers, men who would be getting out pretty soon, but... We also had in the sample some of the toughest men. We've had men who have been in prison 18 years, men who have spent less than a year of their adult life out of prison. Some really tough customers.
Well, tell me about some of your other research at Harvard. What kind of subjects did you use, and why did you choose them, and what were you looking for in your research?
Well, I don't want to use the word subjects because we think of the people who take drugs in our program as collaborators, but we've had as shared these experiences with many writers, musicians, of course many psychologists and Harvard professors. One of the most interesting studies we did was with a group of over 50 professional religious people. There's no language to describe a consciousness expansion experience. Our language in English for describing subjective states is pitifully small. Sanskrit, for example, has over 40 times the number of words we have to describe subtleties of subjective experiences. But one thing that kept being repeated over and over again by subjects, including prisoners, and by very cynical artists and writers, was the religious terminology. They said, well, I talked with God, or I experienced a divine God-like, or now I know what the Bible is about, things of this sort. Well, this is very surprising to us because we were hard-headed behavior psychologists, and we knew nothing about religious terminology, although since then we have read William James. We're working, by the way, in the same clinic that William James started many years ago, and...
You're speaking of his book, The Varieties of Religious
Experience. Yeah, The Varieties of Religious Experience, right. And in that book, James talks about his own experiments with nitrous oxide, in which he says, clearly, this is a metaphysical experience. Well, when we were running into these religious reports by non-religious people, we felt we were out of our depth. So we went to professors and graduate students in the Divinity School. And we've been providing drug experiences for a large number, over 50 now, of these professional religious people. And they're among our best subjects, because for many of them, this is what they've been looking for all their life. Their expectations and their set is for some sort of revelatory, transcendent experience.
What about the case of, say, the actors and writers and poets and so forth? Does the drug lend itself to creative activity?
Yeah, of course, again, you're in a tricky area here, because who's going to decide what's creative? We'll try to duck that question and simply say that creative people respond very enthusiastically to these experiences and claim that it has changed their not only the visions that they get or try to build into their expressions, but also some of the technical problems of communication.
How about, would someone, for instance, take such a drug and then sit down to write a novel and say bat out a chapter while under the influence of the drug and then stop until the next time? Or do you does it have an effect on your creative activity after you are no longer under the influence?
No, you have to distinguish, of course, between the creative experience in which you're experiencing something brand new to you and perhaps brand new to your fellow man, and the creative performance in which you're able to fit symbols together, fit words, or move paint around on a canvas to provide a dramatic or a moving form of communication. We're convinced that our prisoners have authentic, creative, mystical experiences. We're convinced that our prisoners, illiterate and untutored, see what Blake saw, or see what Wordsworth saw, or experience what St. John of the Cross experienced. The problem is they have no words. They say, "Wow, Doc, it's out of this world," or "I just died and came back again." That's the limits of their vocabulary. Creative people, by definition, are interested in carrying this a step beyond that and telling the rest of us in a striking way what they experience.
Does the influence of the drug lend itself to creative communication of something other than the drug experience itself? I mean, would one, as a novelist who is not writing about a spiritual experience, would he feel it easier to write after having taken such a drug if he were writing about other subjects?
Well, I think I understand your question. That is, can you apply the benefits of the drug experience to different intellectual or creative fields, mm-hmm. apart from simply self-discovery? Is that the...
Yes. Well, for instance, let's take it away from the artist. Maybe that's too simple. Let's say a scientist.
Right, right. We are starting a series of experiments in which we have people attempt to learn new material or to solve problems during a drug experience. Last Sunday, for example, we ran an LSD session for a woman who had a learning block about languages. And she's going to Mexico this summer, and she wanted to learn Spanish. So we gave her a very heavy dose of LSD, very heavy dose, about twice what's used ordinarily. And she was in a very quiet room with earphones. And for 8 hours, she sat there motionless, and spoken Spanish was fed into her. After about 3 hours, we stopped. We kept asking her all along, "Do you want to continue?" She said, "Sure." This is she was enjoying it. She said she felt as though she'd been speaking Spanish for the last 100 years. So that not only did she get over her block, her distaste for learning the language, but she was able to incorporate and absorb a lot more than she would ordinarily.
Now, do you think this would be a lasting experience? I mean, will she be able to retain, or do you have any indications of that?
Well, we're going to measure that, but obviously any benefit or any insight you get during a drug experience has to be put into practice. The drug opens up new possibilities to you, but you have to do something about it, and she's going to have to continue to practice, she's going to have to talk, she's going to have to study. But the hypothesis we're investigating is that it will immensely speed this process up. And of course, the problem here is that it's the mind. We were talking this before the program started. It's your mind which keeps you from learning. We know very well that your kids will learn a foreign language faster than you will. That's because our minds are so cluttered up with concepts and English words that they get in our way. The theory here is that LSD knocks out your mind for a period of hours, and your brain, which is a fantastically accurate, sensitive organ, can then pick up whatever stimuli are fed in much more effectively during that period.
I gather that you feel there's a kind of experiential learning that is perhaps as important or more important than the kind of ordinary verbal or intellectual learning process that we go through. Is that correct?
Yes, I do.
There has been a great deal of opposition. Not a great deal, I suppose, but it seems to be growing opposition to the usage of these drugs at all. And yet you claim that the drugs are not harmful physically, and that if used under the appropriate circumstances, are not harmful mentally or psychologically. Why is this opposition building up?
Well, it's a yin-yang, or it's a positive-negative, like everything else in life, it's a positive-negative movement. There's counterbalance. The reason the negative pressure, the criticism is developing, is because the positive pressure is developing. More and more people are having this experience and are getting turned on to a broader concept of life. So the more people that take it, the more people there are going to be to resist it. And these drugs are dangerous to several groups of people. They're dangerous to anyone who has a vested interest in any of our psychological or psychiatric or educational programs, because there's no question in our mind that we open up new possibilities of learning without teachers, of understanding yourself without doctors, and of coming to an awed and reverent understanding of life without a spiritual guide or a minister. Now, this is going to play havoc with lots of the games that are being played and lots of the control which is being exercised in our society. Occurred to us very recently that these drugs cause temporary insanity and panic in certain classes of administrators and perhaps certain forms of psychiatrists who have not taken the drug, but there's very little panic being caused in people who have had the experience. Listen to them. Read the scientific articles which report the questionnaire results of subjects who have taken the drug. When you let the patient, when you let the subject talk, over 66% of the subjects who've had this experience report that it's changed their life, and they list in these questionnaires how it's changed their life. Now, three of these studies, interestingly enough, have been done in California, one by Dr. Keith Dittman at UCLA, was published in the Journal of Mental and Nervous Diseases last year. About 66% of his subjects, and he's a very respectable, conservative psychiatrist, over 66% report dramatic revelations and educational benefits. Dr. McLaughlin over at RAND and Dr. Charles Savage at the Menlo Park Clinic, two other California doctors, have published similar statistics, and we've come up with the same findings at Harvard.
Do you feel that your research or the use of the drugs more generally touches a kind of Puritan nerve in the American character? Is this part of the problem?
It sure does. The open cortex, that is the nervous system operating free of the social games that we play, the fear and personality, your ego and your mind and all that, is basically an ecstatic, accurate organ. And, of course, anything which... it's not the kind of pleasure... Most of our pleasure is game pleasure. We're getting away with something we're not supposed to, but you're still within the game. Anytime you break the rule of society, you're still within the game of society. The kind of pleasure, the ecstasy that we're talking about, is the ecstasy that perhaps Einstein gets when he works out his formula, or that a musician gets when he really has the whole business operating on the keyboard the way he wants it to, or the ecstasy that a mother feels when at certain crucial times in child-rearing. That's the sort of intense pleasure which we're talking about. But because it's positive, I would agree with you, it's frowned upon.
It brings up the problem of a kind of social control of the use of the drug. Should there be some kind of control by society on the use of these drugs? You, for instance, mentioned rules of your own, that you should never take them alone, that you should always take them with somebody who's aware of the kind of experience you would be having. I presume, to begin with, that people don't go out and drive cars recklessly, and they don't murder their wives under the influence of such drugs.
There's no evidence of that. Sure, there are going to be another metaphor. We're in the metaphor making business because we're dealing with experiences for which we have no language. I have to apologize for that all the time. But a very useful metaphor is this one. We're at the same stage of our technical understanding of these drugs as we were 60 or 70 years ago when the horseless carriage was invented. Now, at that time, visionaries, because anyone who talks about something for which we have no language is a mystic. Automotive mystics began talking about the possibilities of the horseless carriage. There were no words like highway, stop sign, traffic cop, toll road, etc., etc. And the hard-headed realist in those days, 70 years ago, would have said, well, how can you possibly use these? The roads aren't made to go faster than a horse can go. There are no bridges over the river. You'll run out of gas. There's very little gas produced in the United States. There are no mechanics to repair these new inventions of yours. And then danger. Who can operate these? Maybe only government officials and the military and doctors should be allowed to use these new inventions. And of course, it's a danger of pleasure, too. People will use the car for kicks and Sunday driving and all that. We don't want that to happen. You can write down the list of all the objections and the fears. The objection to the car was that horses would run away and cows wouldn't give milk and chickens wouldn't lay eggs and there'd be terrible motor crashes. And then, of course, licensing. You're going to have some state control of this. We think that in the next decade or so, we'll have to develop many new social structures to deal with the drugs which provide these new potentials. There's going to have to be licensing. And the criteria for licensing has got to be very similar to that we now use for, say, an airplane pilot. As soon as a responsible adult American has demonstrated to his fellow men that he can use this instrument without danger to himself or to his fellow men, then he should have the right to do this. And we think that the potentialities of the cortex are much more important than a car or an airplane, because we're dealing with the root of the matter itself, how you experience and how you think. And I want to leave one warning with your listeners. As you listen to this debated, this issue as to who's going to control these drugs in the next few years, watch out, because there are going to be lots of people who'll be willing to take over their control and responsibility themselves, who know best how we should experience the world. We use the word internal freedom in this organization we started. That's a far-out title. It sounds like a communist front or something of that sort. But we're going to stick with the term internal freedom, because the American people should learn this term and learn what it means and learn about the possibilities of who's going to control expanded consciousness in the next few decades.